Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to ZUM Podcast number 17. Interview today with Eric Cash. I just want to give you a couple notes on him. He's a stand-up comic, former street performer, traveling circus ringleader, deep history in the punk scene, so we talk a bit about that stuff. He mentions his special Anti-Famous and website, antifamous.com. The website's not up yet, and the special is kind of indefinitely postponed, as far as I know. He will definitely post about it when it's rescheduled, and the best way to find him online right now is Facebook, The Eric Cash. And he'll be performing at the San Francisco Burrito and Comedy Festival. Which you can go to sfcomedyburritofestival.com. I'll be working on the Lost Weekend shows there too. So come by, check us all out, and enjoy the show.
For me or for the computer?
I figured for the things.
Oh, good idea. Yeah.
Good thinking.
So the MacGyver of my kitchen right now is Eric Cash.
Woo-hoo-hoo.
We're trying out a recording in the living room, or in the kitchen right now. Actually, I don't even have the monitor on. I shouldn't take the headphones off.
It's cool. It makes you look spacey.
I know, yeah. So Eric is a comedian who, like a bunch of comedians I've met, you have a pre-existing...
condition?
a pre-existing performance experience, right? Or like, were you...
Yeah, I did a lot of other things for as a comic. I think there's a few of us because we get tired of carrying gear and having to work with other people.
That is exactly one of the things I tell people when they ask me about it. Yeah, like being you don't have to be a roadie for other people. You don't, and then at the end, if you get any money, you don't have to split it up seven ways or whatever.
Yeah, and fight over who's going to buy us a pack of cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. But what was your... Were you ever in a band, or is this the busking thing you're talking about?
I was in hardcore bands. And then I was in hardcore bands on the East Coast. And I was a painter. And then I started a punk rock circus in 1998. And then in 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003, we did 4 U.S. tours. We did a bunch of things. We were on HBO and Discovery. And
what was the name of the group?
We were called the Know Nothing Family Circus Sideshow.
Okay, I feel like I've heard of that, yeah.
You may have. We were kind of a mess.
You guys started... Where'd you guys start out?
Well, I had been in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took off for a little while, and a bunch of my friends were in Boston and Connecticut. And then I moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then I started calling my friends and telling them that they were moving to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I didn't tell them why.
This is 98-ish?
Yeah, and okay. So they started moving there, and I was really crazy, and we started building gigantic puppets, And I don't know how to describe those days. I took a lot of LSD for a long time, and I'm a megalomaniac without it.
Yeah. So, but this started. So the busking stuff started in Boston.
I didn't start street performing until I'd been with the circus for like 2 years. I technically started in 2000. I didn't really have a show until 2001. And I didn't really get it together as a street performer until I quit the circus, because I just didn't want to work for anybody else. And so we would tour during the summer, and then I would try to make money doing street shows in the winter. And I did a magic show for a little while. technically, I've always bounced off and on as a street performer. I was trying to get money for breakdancing when I was a little kid. And then I did fire shows when we were in the circus. And then we did, I used to do this puppetry thing. I had this gigantic puppet named Mama that looked like this old faded gypsy woman. She was built just like the Skeksis Mystics were in Dark Crystal.
Right, right. So you had to have like...
Her head was... I moved with my hand and her neck went over my head. And she had one arm and that was my arm. And then she was just this big pile of rags. And my girlfriend, who was in the circus at the time, Mickey Love, had this beautiful singing voice. And so the act was... Mickey would stand between my legs underneath me in this big pile of hulking rags with this old gypsy woman face. Like, you never had any idea what the hell was underneath it. And I would speak in this, like, really bad Cockney accent, screaming at people to gather around so I could sing a song. And I'd be like, you want to sing it? You want to hear a song? Come on, then. And I would just keep doing this and keep doing this. And then eventually, when we'd have a big enough of a crowd... I would go, a one, a two, a one, two, three, four. And Mickey would belt out with his beautiful voice, I've been through the wilderness. And we'd do like a virgin.
Sounds awesome.
It's really stupid.
Wait, this is it just like in like Cambridge or whatever? Or like...
No, that was in New Orleans. Uh-huh. And I moved around a lot. Sorry, my timeline's crazy. That was in New Orleans like the year that we started the circus. So that's what we would do. We moved from Albuquerque to New Orleans and we were living in a squat. And because the people that we were supposed to stay with when we came to New Orleans had gotten kicked out and just vanished off the face of the planet. We went to their house and were like screaming at their window, and their landlord came out and they're like, they're not here anymore, they're gone. So we opened up a squat and we would take this ridiculous fuck all puppet in a shopping cart 2 miles to the quarter every day and do this stupid act.
And then we would drink
all of it.
Yeah. Now that I've never actually been to New Orleans, it sounds like a really
it's a good place to not make much money and drink every dime you did.
Right, right. Yeah, and it sounds like the only people I kind of know out there were like Quintron and this Pussycat, and like speaking of puppets, like she's great with all that stuff. But if so, you bounced around a lot. So what?
So the new
was the starting
the circus,
out thing? Let's
the circus,
back a little.
The circus was in New Orleans.
Okay, that was New Orleans.
We started it in Albuquerque. And this was like, when we started it, I was so out of my mind. And I can't believe I got these people to move there. And we got a few of us there. And then we hooked up with this group called the End of the World Circus, kind of. And they were out of New Orleans, kind of. They had like three groups, Austin, New Orleans, and I can't remember where the third group was. San Francisco. I don't know why I forgot that. Mm-hmm. But so we were like, we're going to meet up. We were going to piggyback onto their tour, but we went to Olympia, Washington first, the Know Nothings. And my plan in Olympia was we were going to pick up trust fund kids to help us finance our tour, which we did, and that ended really badly.
wait, this is like 2002 or something?
This is in 98.
98, you were in Olympia. Oh man, you probably
were in Albuquerque, New Orleans, and then Olympia.
Probably knew some of the people in Olympia that you, I don't know who you bilked out of, or it wasn't like you're bilking them out of money, they just,
We kind of wound up bilking them out of money, you know? We weren't intending to,
right.
But then, like, I don't remember what fuck was wrong with me or was wrong with everyone that was with me, but I think we tried to go from Olympia to New York in this 36-foot English touring coach that we'd bought for $1,000. I learned how to drive stick in it.
On the side?
It had the driver's side on the right-hand side. It was this beautiful bus that had... All of this is true, by the way. The bus had been knighted by the Queen of England because it had originally been part of the Queen's Royal Procession. And one of the rules is anything that the Queen may ever possibly place her blue blood butt in has to be knighted. I think this goes back to horses and all this shit. Who knows? The royal family makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. But so this bus, we had this certification. So yeah, we kind of bilked him out of money because For one thing, we tried to drive this bus built in 1969 in England from Olympia to New York to start the... Pennsylvania, that's where we went first. We went to a rainbow gathering in Pennsylvania, and it was just awful. And
wait, have you done this before?
We had never performed at one. I had been to one the year before. That's where I met the girl that I started the circus with, Mickey. I was dating. All my stories are totally insane.
That's why I wanted to get you in here.
I had met her at this rainbow gathering while dating this other girl, but the other girl was too crazy and too much of a Wiccan. And me and Mickey were like, screw the rainbow gathering. And we hitchhiked back to her apartment in Albuquerque because this rainbow gathering was in Flagstaff. And so we hitchhiked back to her apartment in Albuquerque and like had a great time. And then I was like, I'm wintering here. And then my group of friends and I had been throwing around this word circus, but it didn't even mean anything. And then she had like friends that were circus people. And I was like, I'm going to move to Albuquerque and we're going to start a circus and we're going to build puppets out of trash. And we're going to change the world and have lots of sex. And
so when
we kind of did, I guess.
But when you guys were talking, when the word circus was being bandied around and you said she knew circus people, was there a clear idea that there was going to be this kind of alternative circus world, and then like I don't know, like
there already was like Chicken John had already. I didn't know any of this stuff at the time. There already was this burgeoning circus scene. It wasn't even burgeoning, I guess. I mean, Jim Rose did his thing in the early '90s, and then Chicken did Circus Ridiculous. I mean, a lot of the people that were in the End of the World show were either ex Circus Ridiculous or people who were never allowed to join Circus Ridiculous.
Right, right.
They were all jilted. I remember most of the End of the World people hated Chicken John. They were, and I didn't know Chicken for years, but people used to call me Little Chicken to insult me, which is weird because it's not like Chicken is tall.
What did you play when you did music also?
I sang.
You're the singer. So.
I also, I played guitar for a while, and then I played in the circus. I played Latin percussion, and I played timbales.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot. I'm not a great musician. I really like to do it, but that doesn't mean I'm good at
it. What were the punk bands you were doing?
I was in a hardcore band called 1984 with...
Oh, I've heard of that.
Really?
Pittsburgh?
Manchester, Connecticut.
Okay.
But it was the same town that, like, Jeff... Like, we used to play shows with Jeff Kashid, who's now in... And, you know, Jeff Kashid is Isis and Red Sparrows, and he's doing a new project with Greg from Dillinger and Julie Christmas called Spilacopa. Cable is from there. That scene produced a lot of stuff.
I'm thinking of 1985. That's the band.
They must have been a rip-off band. I think I'll just mock that. The pit of my eye, I think now, self-pit blood. I think children, women, or adults, lost in 90,000 soulless eyes. Our bass player who started the band with me, his name's Ian. He's in a band called Fracas now.
In the Bay? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've been around forever.
He was in One in the Chamber.
Okay.
Well, he's still in One in the Chamber. I just think they're not really doing shows anymore. And he was involved with, I know he used to live with Matt from High on Fire, and I think they did a project or two together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. Like, Ian is a really good friend of mine, but I can't keep track of what bands he's in because it's usually three and two of them are falling apart.
You know, I wanted to, like, touch on the punk thing because we did mention how, like, having that background, and then when you enter the comedy world, there's one thing.
Maybe, yeah, you have to turn all your ideals around or figure out how to make them fit.
I was going to say if you had the thing, because when I was coming up through that was maybe around the time, like, Riot Girl was starting, and, like, everything was really, and I was in Berkeley, everything was really, like, politically directed and really like identity politics directed. And then like
Berkeley's my baby, but I should have aborted it.
I used to work with that guy.
Had some doubts in the waiting room.
The sense that I had, and also when I bring, and do you know Jessica Seeley?
No.
She's like a young comic who moved here from Washington, and
okay.
She's also like queer and brings a lot of her
mm-hmm.
queer friends to shows, and she's always like, I feel really bad bringing my friends to the shows because I feel like everyone's super sexist and it's like
yeah.
really offensive and they get really bummed out. And I've talked to her about this and I'm like,
and
you know,
misogynistic.
Exactly.
And
it's like, it's a huge
yeah.
part of it. And, I read something you posted about like, you know, like if anyone like takes a pot shot at like a sex worker or anything like that, like that's, you know, ground for just punch him in the face or something. But
yeah.
I mean, that's like, that's more complicated with everything else. But, you know,
I've always felt that way
mm-hmm.
though, even before I married a sex worker.
Mm-hmm.
I've always felt that way because I would be at shows and I would cringe. Like everybody uses the same crappy punchline of like, oh yeah, of course that stripper's just using it for college. And like,
right.
It's not funny for one thing.
Yeah. It's hack, right? It's just a played out thing.
And it's also like, well, why are you casting aspersion on a woman using her sexuality in order to make a living and not explaining, if this is so gross, what you were doing in a strip club?
True that.
There's always that angle to
yeah.
it. Like, no, none of these guys ever owns the fact that they were, like, lonely and horny and in a strip club by themselves.
Coming with that kind of idea, and I'm not saying that everyone who's involved in punk was into it for political reasons or ideologies, or that there's even a coherent ideology. There's not a coherent ideology with punk, is what I think is interesting. But it is the DIY aspect.
Yeah, it was always really fluid, which
yeah,
I thought
yeah.
was really funny. Because there was the scenesterism, and that was where all the people were like trying to follow this fluid idea
mm-hmm.
that kept changing on
yeah.
them. And then there was just all of us involved in it who were like making it up as we went along.
Right.
And yeah.
Did you find any of that in? Because Olympia is kind of notorious for that. I don't know how you fit. How
oh,
you
God,
fit
yeah.
in there. What
Olympia's,
was that all? What was 98 in Olympia?
Olympia is a beautiful, awful, tragic little bubble.
It's so weirdly its own thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And it's like I feel like it's this thing where sometimes I've had great times there and I've had this like mediocre times there and it's like always like. I was like to keep the temperature. I like to keep my know what the temperature.
They're all trying to justify
there.
About 40 political ideologies that are at odds with each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's
really like Berkeley, but smaller. It's like even more. Yeah, like it's more like a.
Yeah, know. And there's not in Berkeley. There's Oakland, right? That
mm-hmm.
Berkeley has influences other than Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
and Olympia is just this little bubble stuck in the woods.
Right.
So there's nothing else other than lumberjacks when you drive out of it.
Like state employees, college kids,
yeah.
weird hippies.
It's so this little
together.
Tiny community of
mm-hmm.
people that go to a college that doesn't have grades.
Yeah.
Are, you know, and they're all, and almost all of them are like Mensa level.
Right.
From rich parents
mm-hmm.
who wanted to be hippies. Like, it's this really odd collection
mm-hmm.
of people.
And I feel like people like us could somehow manage to teach a class there somehow if we just played our cards right.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah. But, I mean, what are you going to teach them?
I have no idea. Were you guys all living in a house together? At this point, it's like 7 people or something, your whole group? The
Know-Nothings? Yeah, at that point, I think it was me, Mickey, Ludwig, Amy... Joshy wasn't exactly with us. We were picking up some of our members in Olympia too.
Oh, really?
And sadly one of them died of leukemia. Which like we just showed up and he had these like lumps in his neck. Like literally it looked cartoony. It looked like a Flintstone ear.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he didn't know what it was and then very quickly like it was very strange.
Right, that was the lymph nodes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, get affected.
Yeah, but no one was diagnosing it. Like, we showed up, and we were like, Bill, what's up with your neck? And he's like, I don't know, I think it's a bacterial infection. And then, like, a week later, they're like, oh, my doctor says it's my wisdom teeth. And then he goes to the dentist, and we call, if I remember correctly, we called because we were supposed to pick him up. And he goes, yeah, you don't need to pick me up. There's a helicopter coming. And we're like, what? And he goes, it's not my wisdom teeth. I have advanced leukemia, and they literally sent a helicopter and picked him up oh, maybe I think maybe he did come home and then packed a bag because they were sending a helicopter to pick him up and fly him to Seattle to go into the cancer ward. See, again, we just totally derailed the story.
No.
There was seven of us. That's the question.
Right. And
about.
Right. And
about 1,100 clown suits.
Okay, so this is, it's like the circus is straight up juggling, happening, clown stuff, like nothing. It's more alternative than that.
We did weird puppet stuff, and then eventually it just turned into the most shocking show ever. Our list of acts was like, one of our clowns would put a power drill down his urethra.
Okay.
His band is actually playing Benders tomorrow. It's called My Graveyard Jaw. He would do that. I did an act that band does from multiple clubs where I shot an apple off an audience volunteer's head with a 9mm.
Oh, shit.
Our finale act was our house musician doing the Bed of Nails, and he was honestly, in my opinion, the best Bed of Nails artist I've ever seen. And then he would suck his own cock to finale the show on his Bed of Nails. The act before that, my girlfriend Mickey would do this. She would do an electricity act earlier in the show that was more a traditional sideshow. And then later in the show, she would do this thing where she stood on her head and lit a light bulb in her vagina.
Where's the power coming from? Is this like the way you can make a potato clock? Yeah, it's like a potato clock.
So I don't reveal trade secrets.
Okay.
What else did we do? I would walk through broken glass.
You guys just made up your own routines?
Up with something that they wanted to do. I would write a bunch around it. We would all egg each other on as to things to do. Like, we were around for years, and we were literally, like, once we started going in that direction, like, my friend Ludwig would gargle his own piss to Iron Man. I can vomit on command, so could peer pressure. We did a few different acts. One of them was a thing where Pierre and Nostril would do this thing where Nostril dressed up like a baby bird and chirp at Pierre's feet while he ate things and then vomited them into his mouth.
Wow.
We also had a 13-piece band in one place.
What the hell? And so this band...
My friend Oro would... And this was actually... We were in Hustler, but in the article was supposed to be about the whole circus, and then they made him focus on Oro's act, where she would hang a six-pack of beer from her labia. God, what else did we do? A lot of things that you probably shouldn't do to yourself.
And this is like... Oh, yeah. So this had to be... There's no equivalent of open mic for the Circus World Rising.
We had an open mic, actually.
We did?
We had an open mic that we would do when we were wintering. I was telling this story the other night. So the circus had this funny thing where everyone else was convinced it was a collective, and then I would continually yell, "Collectives don't work. I'm the boss. Shut up." And so the circus would always be doing... There was this... I was the bad guy, and there was always this, like, mutual antagonism. So they would always try to do things to get past me or make me angry, and it was this constant game for years.
Were you, like, the P.T. Barnum, like, the kind of the ring master?
Yeah, except retarded.
Right.
Yeah, I guess so. I was the MC. Pierre also MC'd for a while, but I was the MC. And I did one or two acts, and I came up with things. I wrote a rock opera at one point. And it made no sense whatsoever, but people liked it. But we had this bar called the Hi-Ho Lounge in New Orleans, and every Wednesday we did this thing we called an open mic, and it was a bunch of drunk people doing things, and then we would come up with new circus acts, and then people also kept saying that it was auditions for the circus, and I was like, these aren't auditions. I'm not taking any of these idiots. But it was useful because, and keep in mind, in a lot of ways, we were just awful people. And there was this one dude that kept asking me if he could be in the circus. And I said no. And he kept asking everybody else. And also, all of our clowns had their makeup tattooed on. And the first one of those was this guy, Nostril Dumbass. And Nostril is just a phenomenon. And so Nostril told him this thing, and he Knossel comes running up to me and is like, I told this guy that if he can do this, he can be in the show. And I was like, well, you know he can't be in the show. And he goes, let's get him to do this. And I'm like, okay. And what he had done is he had told the guy that he could come with us on tour if he could eat a gallon jar of mayonnaise on stage.
Whoa.
And so we go to our open mic, and this guy's like all psyched about this. And I'm like, God, I gotta MC this and make this funny. And me and Pierre co-MC'd it. And so we get this guy, and we go, he's really been wanting to join the show. Blah, blah, blah. And I pull out a chair and a bucket. And we introduce him, and he's like raising his arms like a pro wrestler, and everybody claps for him, get him down. And I tell him, if you can eat that entire jar of mayonnaise in 5 minutes or less.
Oh.
And he looks at me, and I was like, dude, we got to keep this show moving. We can't be watching you eat mayonnaise for 2.5 hours.
I'm going to light you at 4 minutes.
And I'm like, this is just awful. And it was disgusting to watch. And so he sits down with this gallon jar of mayonnaise with this bucket in between his feet, and he starts going for it. And me and Pierre are both emceeing it, just describing how awful it must feel. And like, both of us are actually kind of worried. I don't know what this much mayonnaise will do to the human body.
I don't think that they've done that to rats.
Like,
yet.
I'm so worried this guy is just going to choke or keel and die, like, with mayonnaise, like, pouring out of his eyes. And so he's going for it, and he's going for it, and we're just describing how disgusting it is, too. Like, we're not making this any easier at all. It's just awful from beginning to end. And, like, right at the end, we're counting down 10, 9, and he's shoveling with this gigantic spoon into his face. And he finally, like right at 1 second, he like rings the spoon around the thing and turns the mayonnaise jar upside down. And we go, "You did it!" And he goes, and vomits all 1 gallon of mayonnaise into the bucket. And I look at him and I go, "I forgot to mention you have to hold it down."
Oh, you guys are assholes.
Yeah, we're awful. Really, it wasn't my idea. We would just egg each other on into these like horrible things.
Were you guys doing, had day jobs or anything at that time? Or you were squatting,
you
know, right?
You don't really need, well, no, we weren't squatting, but I think we were paying like $20 a month for our rent. We had this gigantic warehouse that was 3 stories tall called the Ass Palace. And mostly we would just hang out there doing, we had an art studio. Everybody made money different ways. You know, like I would street perform. I wasn't making huge money as a street performer then, but I mean, like, in New Orleans, you figure out, like, in New Orleans, you learn a thing about money, and that's, money is moving around, and all you have to do if you want some of it is put yourself in the way of where it's traveling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I would, like, during Mardi Gras, like, you're not allowed to paint faces on Bourbon Street, but I'm fast, so I would just go down and paint faces, and I'd make, like, $500 in 2 hours.
Right.
You know, I painted the Starship Enterprise on this girl's breasts one time, and it was really funny. I was like, this is the dumbest thing.
With the areola, like, right here?
I had to watch out for cops, and so I was trying to, like, keep an eye out.
The
police there will kill you, you know?
Really?
Like,
are they totally tough? They're
the biggest street gang in New Orleans. They're crazy.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember. She was like, can you do the Starship Enterprise? And I was like, my mom's a big Trekkie, I guess. That was my answer.
So then, okay, so when did the transition happen from the circus into stand-up comedy?
The circus was, like, exploding in 2004. And I had a friend that did comedy. And then I realized, like, that's all I'd been doing was speak. Like, that's mostly what I did in the circus. But
right,
just talked.
MCing, yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm going to move on to comedy. But I hate comedy.
And what was the precedent for you hating comedy?
So much of it is just, like, I grew up on comedy. I don't, you know, like, I love George Carlin. I love Bill Hicks. But I wasn't super into comedy. And most comedy is, like we said, like, the majority, or at least the perception, I think it's definitely changing now.
Yeah.
There's definitely a lot more creative people in it. But comedy just got really stagnant, and it just, you know, I mean, you
yeah, and like, what
men
we're talking
women
about,
are
like,
differently.
Yeah, that kind of
and,
thing.
And it's just, it's just a string of dumb shit, stereotypes that are supporting each other. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like one of the worst things about comedy and comedians is, like, they broadcast the worst parts of their psyche as well as their most boring parts, and then they pat themselves on the back for them, and then, like, it's the opposite of therapy. Like, it's it's how to take everything that's wrong with you and exacerbate it.
Right, right. I can see that. Well, I feel like there is, like, maybe you would have probably been into, like, British comedy, maybe.
I do like British comedy.
Like, yeah, like, and, like, the Kids in the Hall or things like that, mm-hmm. that are, like, there is definitely stuff. I know what you're talking about, and I think...
Like, I think Billy Connolly is one of the most brilliant things ever.
I need to really check out a whole special of his, because people keep saying that he's like, really, like...
Yeah, he's really
king,
amazing.
Because in America, he's not... I mean, he was, like, the guy that headed class for a while. And he's not as well-known, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who think are great in England that aren't really well-known here, but yeah.
You know, one of the things about English comedy, and I think this holds me back a little bit, too, because I want to be this way, but the industry doesn't want me to be this way, is a lot of English comics are a little bit more long form. Even if they're doing short jokes and stuff, they're doing, like, real subtle callbacks. Mm-hmm. And just a lot of, I don't know, it's more long form. It's like
your buddy,
like, if
Matt.
You close your eye, yeah, Matt is like that.
There's a lot of, like, really
I think that he's very, very palatable for American audiences. He's mm-hmm. hilariously funny, But yeah, he's got that very English thing where he hits you with a callback that you never saw coming, like, a good 15 minutes later.
So who was the guy that you were friends with? Was he kind of, like, mentoring you into, like, just, like, going with you to open mics when you started, or how did that work out?
No, although I did start with Sean Patton in New Orleans.
Oh, you did? He's fucking great. He's so good now.
Yeah, and both of us sucked. And
you started at the same time.
He started maybe a year before me in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And there's nowhere to be a comedian in New Orleans.
Really?
And
okay.
And I hadn't run into Sean Patton or realized how good he'd gotten until, like, I don't know, 5 months ago.
I saw him
And he just, like, tore it up at Power Violence in L.A. And I walked up to him, and he was, like, drunk. And he was being kind of rock star-y.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, we started together. We used to both, I was like, you did my show because it was the only show in town other than the show you did.
Right.
Because, like,
is it two you guys in New Orleans?
There's, like, one open mic in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And, well, it may be different now, but it's probably another
it's like
room.
2002
but exactly
or
the same.
3 or, yeah, 2 and 4.
Yeah, 2003, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
There was a room at Carrollton Station, and when you would do it, it was once a week. And when you would do it, people had driven there for 4 hours to tell the worst jokes. And,
right.
like, very quickly, I was like, well, if I want to do comedy, sure as shit ain't doing it here. It was just, there wasn't enough stage time to be had, and everyone in that scene was awful, me
mm-hmm.
included.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sean was funny then, but he was open mic funny, and
mm-hmm.
it was still very standard. It's nowhere near what he's doing
now. He's an amazing storyteller. I like the things that I've seen him do
mm-hmm.
are just basically stories, but
yeah.
he just is so good. I don't know if he's super well known to people outside the comedy nerd world. Well, this could be a good segue into talking about, you're going to do this show in San Francisco.
At Stageworks, yes.
And you're going to be doing an hour?
Yeah.
And you, like, yeah, have you done this hour before? Is this something
yeah.
you've been done? You've been doing it, okay? So
I mean, you've been
doing stand-up for a long.
I've been
time.
Doing stand-up for 8 years.
Right.
Some of this stuff is stuff that was written recently. I'll decide what I'm putting on it
mm-hmm.
at the end of it. I actually think I'm gonna try and do not three completely different sets. But I think what I'm going to try and capture before we go into editing is probably about 90 minutes of material,
mm-hmm.
maybe 2 hours. And then in post, we'll edit it down to make it the best I can.
And your idea is you want to do, like, a online-only kind of release, like a
yeah.
concert video.
What I want to do is I have multiple problems with the comedy industry. One of them is... There's a series of compliments and backhanded compliments that I would get all the time. I think that I'm good. I think that I really like what I do. And I think I know the people that also really like what I do. And like I just said to you before, like, a lot of them are not the kind of people that will normally go see an unknown comedian. Therefore, I can't build my audience and comedy clubs the way that I would like. Also, you know, I road work, like, even if you do great, the club owner wants you to be dumber.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would get this thing all the time where, like, club owners would say things like to me, like, I think you're brilliant, but I think you're too smart for the idiots that come to my club, which is awful. Like, I don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
Like, why don't you stop attracting idiots?
Yeah.
And, like, and why do you feel like you take these people's money every night and you think they're all like, it makes me upset in so many different ways. But the thing is like, I think that there are plenty of people out there that like what I do.
Yeah.
And like, there wasn't a way to get to them before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that old saying, like, freedom of the press only applies to those that can afford a printing press. And before the internet age, we all had to play this game. Well, I didn't want to play that game that the comedy industry wanted me to play. I felt like if I started writing dumber jokes, then the people that really, really do like me would stop really liking me. And I wouldn't like my act. I didn't become an artist to pander. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I wanted to follow somebody else's rules, I'd wear a suit and I'd make a lot more money and I'd do real estate.
You were in the Bay for...
Yeah, and I was here from like 2004 until 2009.
So your whole comedy oeuvre just was developed in the Bay Area.
Yeah. I definitely would think of myself more of a San Francisco comic because I was going... Yeah, I didn't build one joke in New Orleans that I told even a year later. I built my whole act here.
And you have... So you were... At a certain point, you were making a living doing it and touring and doing...
I made my entire living as a street performer, and that's how I supported doing comedy.
Okay. Where this is, like, going down to, like, Union Square and stuff?
I wouldn't work Union Square. I'd work the Wharf, and then I'd travel, too.
Mm-hmm. And what was that act?
It was basically 90 minutes of comedy wrapped around eating fire and walking on broken glass, that if I were to do what I did in my show and not talk, it would take me about 114 seconds.
right, okay.
Most of my show was not doing anything.
Did you have to buy time at Fisherman's Wharf on
the
stage?
No.
What's up with that stage area?
I don't work the stage.
You're off on the side.
I won't touch the stage. There's a much better spot. And I don't want to get into this too much because it's a long, long thing. I actually got in a legal fight with the port and the city because they started permitting the area that I worked.
Okay.
And they basically destroyed what's brilliant about street performing. And the Wharf is a mess now. And it used to be really good shows.
I remember going to see that shit when I was a kid. Yeah, I'd see some guy doing like a comedy juggling combo and we'd just be sitting there all huddled in our coats. And
yeah.
It was awesome. I remember that stuff.
Well, street performing, the problem was I was fighting trying to protect something that most people don't know exists. Like, a great street performer can really challenge boundaries. Like, my show involved around trying to get you to go away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it was dirty, it was crass, you know, like, it was challenging all sorts of lines. And there are other people like me. They were the ones that inspired me to be that way. And it's like this really pure form of anarchy because people aren't supposed to, it's a sidewalk. They're not supposed to be, there's not supposed to be 250 of them standing there watching you for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Like it's against, but they're a diverse crowd. Like they're a more diverse crowd than you'll ever get in a club because the people that are in a club have been filtered by the fact that they wanted to go there.
Right.
And the streets, you just grab everybody that walked by and, you know, you have people that don't speak English standing right next to like, you know, like little metalhead kids from Iowa. And like, you have this crazy diverse crowd that just decided
to stop.
You led them, but they're still like, you know, it's a really powerful thing.
Yeah.
So many people have never seen it.
It's more
and
like
think,
an
and,
to,
and,
yeah.
and I never told people in the comedy industry that I was a street performer because if I did, people would be like, oh, that's cool. So you like juggle and put out your hat. And I'm like, no, I scream profanities at people for 90 minutes and convince a crowd of 250 people to give me $20 bills for being rude.
No, seriously, folks, don't just walk off like that cheap bastard right there. He got pissed off because I called him out of a job interview. He's like, Dan, don't have any damn money. This sucks. You know, he go, seriously, do step forward, shake my hand. That means a lot to me, a lot more than just seeing some douchebag turn his back after 45 minutes. It's okay, we can call him a douchebag. Take a look at that dude. Odds are about 70 to 1. It's okay. The kids don't know what douchebag means. It means the greatest father in the world. I taught my friend's kid that the other day. And then I flew out of town. Sometimes I'm awesome. Here we go. Okay. Okay. I can do this. Then again, maybe I can't. You guys don't know. Maybe I can't survive this at all. Maybe I'm just a suicidal exhibitionist. Woke up today like, I'm gonna end it all, but first, I'm gonna build a crowd of 150 children. Ruin their lives. Like Disneyland in hell. Here we go. Oh man, okay. Ow, crap. Thanks for laughing now, dude, that's nice, yeah? Hang on a second, I'm not laying on that one because it's my show. Matter of fact, not that one either. Not this one. This one. This one. This one. Get that one out. Yeah, you're right. This one looks dangerous. Oh, yeah. Ding, ding, ding. I didn't want that one out. No, you're right. Here, let's get that one. Let's get that one out. I don't want to get a paper cut. You suck. Oh, man. I should have sent that tape to Comedy Central. Hang on, let's get that out of there. I don't even know what that is. I don't think I need to lay on copper to oppress you. Oh, it's from Basil Hayden's. This crowd doesn't know what that is. It's expensive. Here we go. Don't worry, I didn't drink it. Man, I should have sent that tape to Comedy Central. I could be flying to Africa with Dave Chappelle right now. Nope, instead. I'm still out here on a street corner risking my life for a bunch of retarded tourists that want to watch me die.
And that was paying the way so you could lose money doing comedy.
Yeah.
It seems to be a pattern I've seen with a lot of people. When I talk to a lot of people about it, you're always taking a loss on that. But who are some of those other... Was there camaraderie around the street performer world? Like you...
There's a camaraderie amongst circle shows, like guys like me that build a crowd, do a show. And we try, and there's an international community of us, you know, like, and we all get along with each other very, very well. And, even when we hate each other, street performers are part of an international family, and we're like, you know, to this day, like there's probably 11 different countries I can fly into that I don't technically know anyone, but I would have a place to crash if I wanted to, even if that person hated me. I mean, that's the rule among street performers.
Okay.
It's like, you know, even if, and street performers come stay at my house, and sometimes I don't really like them, and I don't even like their show, but, like, they're
that
part
is
of
like
the,
being in a band, yeah.
Yeah, they're part of the family, so, you know, I'll cook you food, and you're allowed
yeah.
to be in the house.
Exactly.
And I may just repeatedly call you names, but that's okay.
Yeah. So that's, you kind of overlap a bunch of different worlds, so that's...
Yeah, I'm never
on.
Satisfied with anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like myopic scenes, but no scene isn't myopic. So, yeah, like I bounce around like with the Cacophony Society Underground Arts scene, and then they get on my nerves in certain ways, and then I hang out with street performers, and
mm-hmm.
I really love them, but they get on my nerves in certain ways, and I hang around with comedians, and they get on my nerves in certain ways. And
the Chicken John people.
Yeah, well, that's what I meant when I say
Cacophony
and
yeah,
Underground.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I don't know, I'm friends with a lot of Satanists, and...
yeah. So you're just...
I like freaks and weirdos.
You like freaks and weirdos, but you're never totally satisfied in just settling with these people, in a way, or...
Yeah, I don't know, but I think it's more like just... a hungry for experience kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why in the 90s and the 80s, that's why we all became punks. It wasn't because we wanted mohawks and leather jackets. It was because we wanted something other. In some way, we viewed whatever was around us as drudgery, and we wanted out of it.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to find something interesting, find something with meaning, or find, you know what I mean? And I think I'm still like that.
Oh, I think the one thing I was thinking about, and it is kind of related to like why I like asking people about family stuff, because I feel like part of what, at least my experience is, I kind of did the same thing. Like, I'd be in a different group for maybe 2 or 3 years and kind of build something there. And the more I think about it now, I'm like, I was kind of trying to build my own family unit.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the support structure of friends is usually just that. But
I've been talking about that a lot with friends lately, about how chosen family is quite often much more powerful and much stronger bonds
than
blood family.
That's kind of a good segue, I guess, in a talk.
Because I think a lot of us
are
like that. We're just, you know, we moved on, and I don't know. Like, I always call my friends, like, the Isle of Broken Toys.
Yeah. It's like there's a comics are definitely, I feel like that's the majority of comics, too. Like, there's some kind of psychological.
I think it's the majority of artists.
Right.
In general.
Mm-hmm.
Comics are like that, but people would only say that more about comics because we wear it on our sleeve, kind of, you know?
Right. You don't think about a certain, like, you know, high art painter person
mm-hmm.
as being in the same zone. But I think for, at least even being drawn to, like, punk, a lot of it is just, like, anti-authoritarian, and, like, you had issues with, like, authority figures, and, like, that's kind of what I think I associated with it, like, because I definitely felt like I had that coming up.
Yeah.
But
I was definitely looking for that, as well as something that supported creativity more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, you being from the Bay Area, maybe that wasn't something. I was living, you know, I lived in Seattle when I was younger, but most of the time, like, I lived around people that were very blue collar,
mm-hmm.
and their goals in life were to continue to be blue collar. Like blue collar people really got brainwashed. You know, they believe in. Never take a dollar that you didn't earn. However, the people that run this country are all about take $5 that you earned and then figure out how to make that $5 into $35 while you do something else. Like, that's how you make money.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, like, you know,
that's like, yeah,
like the blue collar people, it's so self-defeating, and there's this pride about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I denigrate that, but when you grow up in that, like, you know, you try to be an artist or whatever, and people are like, well, yeah, but what are you gonna do for money? And I'm like, well, I don't know, but I'm watching you be miserable for money, so how about I figure out how to not care about money? How about that's what I'll do.
And that's, I feel like I kind of had a similar realization. I was like, you know, like, I never, like, played music to make money, and I never, like, did any of, like, the artistic projects I did to make money. And I accomplished that.
Yeah, you accomplished not making any money. Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah, you know, I pat myself on the back all the time about it.
Not anybody could not do it, but...
You know, I had the follow-through. I had the real follow-through. You know, coming from my background. So so you're doing comedy in SF. You end up in L.A. at some point? Is that...
I was in L.A. I took off and I toured...
Yeah, you did a lot of traveling.
I went to Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. And then I wound up in L.A., and I was kind of miserable there, but I was just starting to like it, and that's when my girlfriend got sicker, and I came up here to take care of her again, and so now I'm back in San Francisco. I haven't decided if I'm going to stay here or not. One of the reasons I'm moving forward with this special is I think that it'll be really helpful for my career. I don't think it's going to make me rich. I don't think it's going to make me famous, but I think it'll make it a little bit easier to be on stage every night and pay the rent, and I think that's good enough. That's
like,
all I ever cared about.
Like, it'll help you get booked.
Yeah, and I think that it'll also help for international festivals and stuff, and,
mm-hmm.
and where I'm at right now, like, I really want to be... Like, if I can establish 2 months of work in Australia, 2 months of work in the UK, and then work... both here in L.A., like, I could be happy with that.
Do people freak out about your royalty bits in the U.K.? Have you done that over there?
I've never performed in the U.K.
Okay.
I've done those bits in Australia, and they just think they're hilarious. I actually was wondering about that, because I wanted to do Edinburgh, and I was like, I wonder if you can say that the Queen has tentacles.
I feel like the thing with the royalty there, and it's... The same thing I talked to.
I would be totally willing to do it just to see if I get arrested, though.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I feel like it's the same thing.
Like, we're beyond the point of getting arrested for saying fuck. No one cares if you say fuck anymore.
Unless you're
but
in Russia, apparently.
But if, I think if... Well, yes, but, you know.
that's Russia.
Yeah.
But I think if I got arrested for implying that the queen was a trans-dimensional inbred elder god in Britain, that would be nothing but good for my career.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So my goal is, like I said, I was sitting there and I was like, you know what? Almost all the bands that I listen to are releasing their things for free online. I'm a huge fan of open source and data. I think that the internet and open source mentality is changing the world entirely.
Mm-hmm.
I've always felt that way about the music industry, about entertainment. It's like, you're going to have to stop making money on merch. You just change the pricing model. Stop fighting piracy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I used to drag around Frankenchrist when I was 13 with, if you turn the cassette over, it said piracy is killing the music industry. We left this side blank so you can help.
Yeah.
I've been of that opinion since I was a little kid. And so I was like, well, you know what? There's people out there that like what I do. So I'm going to dump all of my resources into recording the nicest hour-long special that I can, and then I'll release it for free online.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect it to go viral, but I look at it and I'm like, I can book a rock club rather than a comedy club. I'm fine with that. And if I have 20 people in 20 towns that will pay $7 to $10 to see me, then I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year there'll be 25. I'm fine with that. That's totally fine with me. That's all I want.
Yeah.
The problem is that
you live in San Francisco.
the problem is that I didn't start promoting
uh-huh.
the show until yesterday.
Yeah. Well, you've been dealing with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So.
With what I was going through, I came on the day that I lost her. I had been so motivated in taking care of her. I basically thought I was invincible. I was like, I had been going a million miles an hour for months, and I was also like, okay, well, this is going to hurt worse than anything has ever hurt me in life. So that's it. I'm done, right? Nothing can stop me anymore.
Because I know what you're talking about, but I might need to explain going back a little bit. Because you ended up here.
I kind of don't want
to
talk.
You don't have to talk about it. Okay.
If people look me up, they can find
me. Yeah, you can look it up. But you came up here to deal with the cancer stuff.
Yes,
I met the
love of my life on January 1st. I was resistant to dating her at first, and then I fell in love with her, and then she had stage 4 cancer when I met her, but I didn't really realize that. I knew she had cancer, and she'd already had a mastectomy, but I'll make the story as fast as possible.
I mean,
tell it, because you're right, it makes sense in the thing. In March, she sent me a text that said the cancer had moved into her remaining breast. I texted her back, and I said, do you want me to come? And she said, yes, and so I dropped everything and I moved back to San Francisco to help take care of her and to be with her.
Mm-hmm.
And in April, her condition started going really out of control. She had a really extremely aggressive form of breast cancer. And she, we admitted her into the hospital in May with extreme chemo sickness and dehydration. She stayed in that hospital for a long time. On June 3rd, I proposed to her at 3 a.m. And at 11 a.m, her team of doctors came in and informed us that her cancer had metastasized to the lining surrounding her brain. We got married on June 10th, and 2 weeks later, I was able to take her home into hospice to the apartment I had gotten for us, and on July 3rd, she took her last breath while I held her hand. And then I'm going to transition right into talking about something else.
No, go for it.
Just to get this.
She's
a beautiful lady, and she's an incredible person. And if you look me up, you can find out who she is. And if you want to look into her life more, I suggest that you do, because she was incredible. But anyway.
And let me know, I've only met you in the last few months, so this is all been going on. Yeah,
it's a big story, and I also am trying to live past it now, too.
No, I was going to say, that's part of this, right? Yeah.
And that's part of why I'm doing this. But the thing is, I walked out of that. I had planned to do this in March,
mm-hmm.
before I even moved up. I'd planned it for July 6th and 7th. And
to do it in the Bay or to do it in LA?
To do it in the Bay, at StageWorks. And in May was when she was getting really, really, really bad, and I called Ty at StageWorks, and I was like, I'm going to have to cancel. There's no way I can do this right now. She's like, that's fine. And basically, after Holly died, I was like, okay, well, I have to go. I have to do this now. This is my. I need to move forward with things. It's the right thing to do. It's a smart thing to do. And so I called her up, and I was like, okay, I want to book some new dates. And she goes, how about August? She goes, I got August, this. And I was like, actually, instead of two, let's do three nights. Because I was feeling all invincible. And I was like, I'm going to get off the phone, and I'm going to do the write-ups, and I'm going to print posters, I'm going to do this. And I got off the phone, and I walked back inside. And then I spent the next month laying on the floor, freaking out.
Yeah.
And I'm still kind of in that state.
But you gave yourself a deadline, in a way.
I should have started promoting this, like, 5 weeks ago. I'm promoting it now. I'm going to print up a big stack of flyers.
But
if anybody listening to this would like to come, not only am I pretty funny, but I'm also performing with Bucky Sinister, who is incredible. He's a great storyteller and awesome guy, also from the punk scene, and a self-help author.
And
Natasha Muse, who was voted the funniest trainee in San Francisco, which there is competition for that in the city. I think she's really brilliant.
Oh, she's great, yeah.
August 30th, 31st, and September 1st at Stage Works.
Mm-hmm.
Tickets are available at brownpapertickets.com for $10 presale.
Mm-hmm.
I would love it.
And he's funny. I'm vouching, and I'm interviewing the guy. I've seen him. I've seen his act. So,
I think I'm funny.
You know, I mean, you also the hour that you're doing. You know that, so it's more like the promotion that you're stressed out about. You're not.
Oh yeah,
about the show.
I'm never like you know when I was going through everything, and all the comedians knew what I was doing. They would call me
sets.
All the time, and they would be like, I was doing sets constantly.
Yeah.
And they would be like, do you want to cancel? And I'd be like, what do you mean? Do I want to cancel? I was like, I'm battling cancer. Like, I don't know how to do that. I know how to comedy. I can comedy all day.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I go through
talking to doctors
and
running all over the city and doing this and doing this.
Yeah.
And I go to a set. Well, that's like
a break.
I've been doing this forever. I know how to do it. Like,
mm-hmm.
I could succeed, and then the people would clap, and then I could feel good, and then I'd go right back into fighting this losing battle, you know?
Yeah. I remember I booked you before I knew about exactly what was happening, and and I just wanted to give you the out. Like, if you need the time.
Yeah, and a lot of people said that to me, and I was like, no way, you booked me. I'm there. I'm so there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think I saw you the day after, and I didn't realize that had happened. Or like
you didn't see me the day after.
The business show.
Oh, were you at the business
show? I was at the business show.
Yeah. That was weird. It was the day after. We were keeping the news quiet at
mm-hmm.
that point. And so I couldn't really talk about it. I was in a really weird state of shock.
Yeah.
It's really weird because when you go through something like that, I was in pain from day one. I was losing it. But I had been in pain too, like watching her go through this. It was awful. And it didn't really start to hit until weeks after, and I'm still in that state now. I have more hours where I'm together, but like I looked at my Facebook from last night, and apparently I just had a big freak out, and like
I've been following your Facebook.
I never misspell anything, and I'm going through my comments on it, and I'm like, was I typing with my face? What was I doing?
You're just noticing you're misspelling.
As I'm reading it this morning, I'm like, I'm noticing there's a towel next to the computer, and I'm like, what is that? And I'm like, oh, apparently I poured an entire beer all over the floor, and there's like dents in the table from me punching it. I'm like, apparently Eric had a little night is what happened. I don't remember doing it.
Is your place furnished? Is it all your stuff? Is it you're gonna get your deposit back?
No, it's furnished with me and Holly's furniture and her stuff and
mm-hmm.
yeah,
and the cat. You have
the
cat now.
The loud cat.
Mm-hmm.
Which
so not this one.
Which if she can hear my voice anywhere out there through the power of digitization, I just wanted to know that the cat meows now and he meows a fucking lot and he's really and he doesn't speak English, so I can't ask him what he wants. I honestly didn't want to talk about any of that stuff
at all.
Sorry
about that. Yeah.
It's really weird.
I've only known you for a couple
not
months.
Talk
yeah.
about it right now. You know, it was a little more than a month ago.
Yeah, totally.
And it was the biggest thing, probably. I hope it was the biggest thing that will ever happen in my life. Anything bigger ever happens, I know my chest will cave in on itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're trying to like do your thing. You're going to do your shows. You think you're going to maybe move back to LA?
I don't know. The goal is to put this thing together, immediately start submitting to like Melbourne Comedy Fest and stuff like that. I like San Francisco. I'm a little bit more established in LA
mm-hmm.
now than I was when I first showed up there. And there are a lot of things that I like about LA. So what I would like to do is try to establish myself as working in and out of the country as much as possible, as well as here in LA.
Yeah.
And that I think that San Francisco is simultaneously a really great place and a really bad place for comedy, you know?
Yeah, like, I've been trying to suss that out with people. It seems like people hit a ceiling, and they've got to bounce.
Yeah,
they just...
but it's also a more pleasant place to live.
That's true.
In L.A.
Yeah.
L.A., like, there's good things, there's bad things. And I have a few things coming up.
Yeah, you're just in a movie, right?
It's not a movie. It's a web series.
It's a web series?
And when it was first pitched to me, I was just like, that sounds fun. Because basically what happened is my friends put together this Batgirl web series. And the Batgirl they're using is Stephanie Brown, who none of them felt like she had been ever fleshed out enough in the comics. So they wanted to do this fan fiction thing. And mm-hmm. when it was first thrown at me, my friend Sax was like, hey, dude, I wrote you into this thing
yeah.
as a villain. He's basically you, and he's based on that symbol that you have stenciled on the back of your jacket. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I don't know the stencil.
It's
yeah.
tentacles that are in the
oh,
form
okay.
of DNA.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, his name is Tentacle, and blah, blah, blah. And at first I was like, I'm a Gotham City supervillain? That's awesome! But I figured, oh, fan fiction, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And then I guess in like February, he had told me, and I was like, sure, I'll do it. That sounds fun. And then in February, he's like, hey, dude, we're shooting some of the Batgirl stuff. I'm not sure if we're going to need you today, but do you want to come by anyway? And I was like, I got nothing to do. That sounds fun. And I show up. What I didn't realize is that everyone involved in this is legit industry. They're doing this as a labor of love. Like, there's props on the table from Battlestar Galactica. Like, all these people work in television and movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I also didn't notice that they had gotten, I didn't know until then, that they had gotten the fight choreographer and motion director that worked on Star Trek and Thor. And so I show up, and what I think is going to be this dinky little web series is the best Batgirl outfit that I've ever seen in this tough-as-nails girl named Marisha Ray, who's awesome. And they're filming 17-hour days of the most intense fight scenes I've ever seen.
And everyone's just donating their time and labor.
Yeah,
to it.
And like, and these fight scenes aren't like biff biff. It's like Batgirl like comes in on this rope, and 15 guys descend on her, and she hits this guy. This guy picks her up. She kicks these two guys in the face. She flips
wow.
this one. And I was just giddy.
Dude.
I was like, "This is amazing."
She's gonna get to be the next girl with a dragon tattoo or something. That's what's gonna happen.
This thing should look great. Like.
Can you find on YouTube right now, or is
yeah,
there,
yeah.
Is
you,
anything
if
up?
You look up Batgirl Spoiled,
mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of buzz, as well as the trailer. And that's the other thing that I was going to say. The trailer is cool, but all of us are slightly disappointed in it, all of us on the Batgirl team. But the reason that we're disappointed in it is because as we've now filmed a couple episodes, and everybody's figuring this thing out, so it's getting better and better and better. So I look at the trailer and I'm like, like when I saw the rough edit of the trailer 3 months ago, I was like, awesome. And now I look at it and I'm like, that's nothing. Because the new stuff looks, you know what I'm saying? It looks better.
Yeah, yeah. Once you kind of have all those things.
And we'll be
out,
going to comic book conventions and doing live fights and stuff. We're going to Kamikaze.
Is anyone from DC like kind of champing at the bit about this? Or
so far, not one word. The thing is we're pretty sure as long as none of us make any money on it,
mm-hmm.
they won't sue us.
Okay.
And it's basically a very, please don't sue us, we love comics,
mm-hmm.
this is why we're doing this sort
yeah.
of thing. One of the reasons my character was created was Sax felt that if we created a character, that it reduces the likelihood.
Right.
He likes me. He likes me as a personality. He mm-hmm. thought I would be a good Batgirl villain.
Yeah.
And if we created my character, then it's less of DC's foot
yeah.
we're stepping on. That was the logic there.
And I could also see, like, in the same way, and I mean this in a complimentary way, like, you would be, like, a perfect, like, Riddler-type person or something.
I've been, yeah, like, people always go, like, oh, yeah, you would be a really good Batman villain. And I'll be like, I've been grooming myself as a super villain since I was in my teens. Like, look at my old headshots. It's like me with red hair and a green suit, like cross-processed against
yeah.
this crazy background.
And I think there's something to that. Like, I mean, I think, like, I've...
Like, heard, I grew up on comic
yeah.
books. I always... And I'm a life as arter. Like, I've always been, like, if you build it, they will come, and if you live it, it'll be real. Like, you know, like, I still read, like, psychedelic out there comics to this day. I like, it was the biggest compliment that I could be given to,
yeah.
to be not only a Batman villain, but a Batman
villain,
a customized one based on me. I was like, oh, that's rad.
Yeah, yeah. I think about, like, this thing that Biafra said when he was doing, like, his whole thing was when he started, he's like, instead of being, like, the John Wayne character, the good guy, he's like, the bad guy is always more interesting.
Yeah.
And that's, like, I think a perfect.
Yeah. Well, I've been heavily influenced by Biafra, too. Mm-hmm. Ever since I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
and I remember that same statement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely, and I've always felt that way too. Like, mm-hmm. you know, and I grew up on westerns too. You know, and like western villains, especially in old spaghetti westerns, like they're just these brilliantly awful people. Acting scares the crap out of me. I'm like, I'm gonna watch this, and it's gonna be awful.
Weird. That's weird. Scares you more than doing stand up, which is
for some reason I'm really
your...
comfortable with stand up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know your set, I guess, is the thing. You're not beholden to another person when you do your routine.
Yeah. Yeah, and stand-up allows for a lot of self-delusion. As long as you trick the people into clapping and laughing, you can convince yourself at the time that you're awesome. I think as long as you keep feeling slightly differently about what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
keep changing what you're doing, then you're evolving as an artist. Like, the whole point of this is just to, like... grow, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did music for a really long time,
mm-hmm.
and that was kind of my thing. And I was like, in the point where I was like, I was promoting shows, I was playing in bands, I was running a record label, I worked at a label, I had all the stuff where it was just like, I couldn't get out of it in a weird way. Like, I was just
mm-hmm.
like, my
yeah.
whole social life and everything creatively was wrapped around that. And I kind of feel like the only in the last year was I able to take a break from it. And that's the only time I was able to be like, oh, I really, the comedy thing, I get the same jolt of, like, validation and, like, crowd
yeah.
contact that I was dividing and diluting with music.
Uh-huh.
You know, splitting that up.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say is, like, when, you know.
And you were in a band, so you know how that goes.
Yeah, and I was talking to Violet from Extra Action the other day, and she was talking about that because I think a lot of us as performers have this weird duality of being total extroverts and total introverts at the same time. Like quite often I don't want anyone to talk to me at a comedy club. I don't want anyone to talk to me. And then I go up on stage and I want everyone to clap for me. And then I come off and I just want to just curl into a ball.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Violet was like, yeah, she was like, she's being all sarcastic. She's like, yeah, yeah, I don't know anything about that. And I was like, yeah, but you get to hide behind, you know, a 14-piece marching band with an 11-member
mm-hmm.
flag team that's half naked. She goes, yeah, I know. You know, in comedy, you're just naked. You're like, you're just standing up there holding this microphone with a light on you as if what you have to say matters.
So what do you, were you cognizant that when you started things were not good, or that you thought the jokes were really like,
No. I knew that I was really bad in the beginning.
That's a good reality check, I guess, to have.
Well, because I came from other backgrounds, and so
mm-hmm.
I knew that I was capable of much more and that I just wasn't capable of it yet.
But also, like, I think when I compare, like, people like you or I that have performing backgrounds, and then right now I'll meet, like, a 22-year-old or a 19-year-old, and they're also, in the last few years, comedy has become a thing that you can aspire towards, where, I think, maybe, like, in, like, the late 90s or 2000, it wasn't, like, a viable career option.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing has happened with music. I feel like there's all these people like, I just graduated from, what, blah, 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 this nice school, and what are you going to do? Like, oh, I'm going to be in a band, because that's like being in a startup. It's like,
yeah.
I'm gambling on my band. I'll be able to cash out at one point on my band. You know, that's kind of, it's a similar idea.
Yeah, but I think...
not that the comics are
I think there's a weird thing in that, too, where people get convinced that bands make money. Like,
no,
I know many people in bands, you know, like, I have two friends, you know, like my friend Danielle from Guar never really made any money on
Guar.
Yeah.
Was she out or is she still in it?
I don't know. I'll call her later and find out if she's in or out.
Guar makes, I thought Guar makes some money.
She makes her money by doing things that Guar allowed her to do. She makes her money. She does set design.
Mm-hmm.
She does all these things. But like, Guar is, like, a very, very successful band.
Mm-hmm.
Guar did every little thing to make money. They printed newsletters. They, you know, like, they sold all this mail order stuff. They became this cult.
Yeah.
And still... You know, like, all my friends that are in successful bands, like, quite a few of them, like, have day jobs.
The great thing about Guar, though, is, like, they can be fucking old forever. No one knows what they look like.
Yeah.
They could menudo that shit.
Well, you know, Danielle is pretty much the only original member other than Dave Brocky.
Okay.
Dave is, you know, like, they've had certain people that worked with them for a long time, but as far as I know... Danielle is the only original member other than Odorous Yarnagus. Like, I was talking with Scott Byben as I was trying to write up, because I can't write myself up at all. I don't know. I can't do a bio because I don't know. I'm not a salesman. I don't know the right thing to sell. And it's like, if I describe myself as weird and surreal, when I think weird and surreal, I think Will Franken.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not Will Franken. Like... I do something that is like, sounds like regular stand-up and then gets really weird out of the middle of nowhere. That was always what I tried to do. Like,
it feels like very Hunter Thompson kind of in a weird way. You know, like there's like
that
spirit.
Cool.
There's like this sort of that spirit and like almost, yeah, it's not like, it's not improvised. It's not like, you know, beat poetry shit or whatever, you know, but I think there's something about like that.
Well, one
of
the things that I worked on for a long time too.
The surrealism, yeah.
Is trying to figure out how to make it so that people couldn't tell when I was improvising and when I was doing written stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I do a whole bit about this too, where like everything that I got beat up and called a faggot for liking when I was a kid is suddenly popular because the modern perception of what the mainstream likes, turns out that perception was totally wrong, which is the other reason why I'm putting this video out. I'm like, look,
right.
If AMC is making zombie TV series from an obscure comic book that people were making fun of me for reading 9 years ago, and it is becoming one of the most popular things on television, like, I look at all this stuff that's happening, and it's like everything that made you a nerd and made you... made you get shit on when you were a kid my age in the 80s, like, it turns out, no, that stuff is really popular.
Because there's a feedback mechanism more directly, because before, you got to count on, like, a Nielsen family or something.
Yeah,
to tell
and
you
what
was
and
going
what
on.
Hollywood thought while they were all doing coke.
Mm-hmm.
And Hollywood had that same mentality of the comedy club owner that I was talking about before, that is like, well, I think you're brilliant, but the morons of, you know, like, you know the old saying, will it play in Peoria? It's an old... showbiz saying, and I've always hated that. And
it's also condescending to Peoria.
Exactly. I've always felt like Hollywood does this awful thing where, number one, they think people are dumber than they are, and then they pander to that imaginary dumb person as smart people. Like, it's really awful.
Yeah.
And I never wanted to do that. I was like, I can't, you know, again, that's why I'm doing this thing and releasing it for free. Like, all I need is the weirdos that like the weird shit that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Just need enough of them to buy enough tickets that I can get to the next town and do it again and pay some bills and go home and feed the cat. That's all I care.
All right. Well, I think that's actually probably a good way to wrap this one up.
All righty then.
It's a good lining. Eric Cash, thanks for coming to the kitchen.
Woohoo!
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Do you have a website? I'll throw it on the.
I went through not having a website for years. I'm putting up another one next week. It's called antifamous.com.
Okay, right on. Antifamous.com.
All right, thanks for listening to the show. If you would be so kind, please leave us a nice review and rating on iTunes. Also, check out the Zum website, zumonline.com, and I'm going to be posting a bunch of podcasts in the upcoming weeks, because I got laid off from my job, and I got a little bit of a backlog, so I got some time to edit. Maybe we'll get into a bi-weekly zone. I'm going to be talking to, in the next couple weeks, Tony Bedard from Icky Boyfriends and Phil Elverum from Mount Erie. So, hope to have those in the can and to you sooner than this one was. I was kind of sitting on this for a couple of reasons, but it seemed like as good a time as any to just promote Eric's Burrito Fest show. All right, this is George signing off.